You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the Complete Collected Works, Volume 175, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context, 17 Lectures, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 7, given in Berlin on the 20th of March, 1917. Today I should like to introduce a sort of historical survey into the process in which we are engaged, not so much in order to venture into history for its own sake, but rather because there is much in the cultural life that surrounds us at present that can be brought to a clearer focus through a survey of this nature. It was in 1775 when a very remarkable book appeared in Lyon, a book which very soon, at any rate by 1782, became accessible to certain circles of German cultural life and had a far greater influence than is normally supposed. Its influence was, however, of such an extent that it more or less had to be suppressed by the main impulse underlying cultural development in the 19th century. This book is of the highest interest for those wanting to inform themselves about what happened from earliest times until our own times. I am referring to the book titled, Readers Aside, again forgive my attempt at French here, end of Readers Aside, title is Des Erreurs et de la Vérité by St. Martin. Anyone trying to read this book today, whether in its original language or in the German edition by Matthias Claudius, who has also written a beautiful preface to the translation, will find it extremely difficult to understand. Even Matthias Claudius himself admits this, and this was at the end of the 18th century. He says, in what is, as I have said, his beautifully written preface, quote, "Most people will not understand this book. I do not understand it properly either. But it made such a deep impression on me that I think it should become more widely known." Close quote. No one will be able to make anything of this book, who, without having the slightest knowledge of these subjects themselves, approaches it from the standpoint of those physical, chemical, and similar world conceptions that are taught in schools today, or which one imbibes through one's general education. Nor will the book appeal to someone who derives his knowledge of the present times, a phrase which is to be preferred to, in quotes, political views, from ordinary newspapers, or from the modern cultural attitudes influenced by them and reflected in various topical magazines. There are several reasons why I am speaking to you about this book today, after the two public lectures that I gave last Thursday and last Saturday. In these two lectures, I spoke about the nature of man and the various members of his being, and about the connection between the human soul and the human body, in the way that one will eventually come to speak about this relationship when the scientific knowledge that is currently available, but which cannot be appreciated for what it is, can be perceived in the right way. Someone who is in a position to know about these matters from a spiritual scientific standpoint will have the clear conviction that people will no longer speak about the relationship of the soul activities of thinking, feeling, and will to the human organism in the way they do today. It is, therefore, my opinion that with these two lectures, a beginning has been made with respect to what is bound to come, even though it may perhaps be postponed for a long time in the wider world, through the considerable resistance which not science itself but scientists themselves exhibit. Even though it may take some time, it will nevertheless eventually come about that the relationship between the human soul and the human body will be perceived as has been outlined in these two lectures. In these lectures, I spoke about these things in the way that I believe is necessary in 1917. What I mean is the way one needs to speak once one has taken into account all the scientific research and other relevant human experiences. It would not have been possible to speak about all these things in the 18th century, for example. In the 18th century, one would have spoken about them completely differently. People are not sufficiently aware what an enormous significance it had that, as I have frequently indicated, roughly at the end of the first third of the 19th century, during the 1830s and 1840s, there was, from a spiritual point of view, a crisis of immense magnitude in the development of European humanity. I have often characterized this by saying that at this time, the tide of materialism reached its highest point. I have also often drawn attention to the frivolous way that people talk about our time as a period of transition. Of course, every age is a period of transition, and this expression, quote, our time is a period of transition, close quote, is entirely reasonable, because that is what every age is. But the point at issue is not that it is being said that a particular age is a period of transition, but rather to establish what kind of a transition it is. There will always be particular turning points which represent deeply radical times of transition in human evolution, and one such fundamental transition in human evolution occurred at the time indicated, even though little attention is paid to it today. There is therefore a need to understand that we must speak today about the riddles that directly concern human beings with totally different words and completely different expressions, and approach the subject in question from wholly different points of view than was the case in the 18th century. There was perhaps no one in the 18th century who spoke with such an intuitive awareness and attentiveness about the scientific ideas of his time, with respect to questions of a similar nature to the ones that we are speaking about now, as St. Martin. In all that he said, however, St. Martin was not yet, as we are now, at the dawn of a new age, but in the twilight of the old age. And he speaks with a twilight mood. So, unless one keeps the point of view that I am about to express clearly in view, it might appear to be almost a matter of indifference whether one concerns oneself with St. Martin at all, whether or not one studies this distinctive form of the ideas aroused in him by Jacob Boehme. It might indeed seem to be a matter of indifference, were there not a very different and deeply significant viewpoint to be considered, to which I shall refer in the course of today's lecture. To mention a specific case, in the course of pointing out the errors to which people are prone through their philosophy of life, and through what their path to the truth might be, parenthesis, for his book is, after all, called Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, close parenthesis, St. Martin speaks in such a way that he uses certain concepts and ideas that were current in particular circles right into the 18th century in the most pertinent way possible. The way that he expresses himself makes it clear that he is very used to working with these ideas. So we find that as St. Martin launches into a consideration of man's relationship to the whole cosmos and to ethical life, he draws upon three principal ideas or concepts which play such a big part in the thinking of Jacob Boehme and Paracelsus, and through which people sought, at the time, to understand nature and also man: mercury, sulfur, and salt. Through these three elements of mercury, sulfur, and salt, they tried to discover the key for understanding both outer nature and man. A person today who would want to speak in accordance with the way that a modern scientist speaks, and this is necessary if one is not to go back to the past, cannot think of the three words, mercury, sulfur, and salt, in terms of the ideas with which people in the 18th century associated them. When people spoke about mercury, sulfur, and salt, they conceived of a threefoldness which someone today, if he is speaking out of a scientific insight, could only rightly represent by dividing man in the way that I proposed, into the digestive system, the breathing system, and the nerve system, out of which the whole human being is composed. For everything belongs to, in one way or another, to one of these systems. And if one supposes that any particular part does not fit into this picture, as one might in the case of the bones, this would only be apparent. People in the 18th century understood that the whole of man's being can be understood if one has the overall conception of mercury, sulfur, and salt. Now, of course, when an ordinary person, or a chemist, speaks about salt, he is referring to the white grains that he has on the table, or to the salts that the chemist prepares in his laboratory. When he speaks about sulfur, the ordinary person thinks of matches, and the chemist of all the experiments that he has carried out in his retort for the transmutation of sulfur. As to mercury, one thinks of ordinary quicksilver, and so on. In the 18th century, people did not think in this way. Today it is very difficult even to imagine what was living in their souls when they spoke of mercury, sulfur, and salt. St. Martin put the question in his own way at that time. How do I divide man if I regard his bodily organism as a reflection of his soul? His reply was on these lines. I first need to consider man with respect to the instruments, the organs of his thinking. Parenthesis, he puts it somewhat differently, but we must interpret it a little so that the explanation does not take too long. Close parenthesis. I first need to consider man with respect to the organs of his head. What is the main characteristic involved here? What do we need to consider? What is the active agent in the head, or as we would say today, in the nervous system? His answer is salt. And by salt he means not the white grains, and also not what chemists understand by salt, but the totality of those forces at work in the human head when a person has an idea. Everything associated with the outward effect of salt he regards merely as a manifestation, an outward revelation of the same forces that are active in the human head. He then asks, which element works primarily in the human chest region? In accordance with the way that I distinguished the members of man's being in my lecture last Thursday, we would put it a little differently. What is at work in the region of man's breathing? St. Martin replies, sulfur. So that according to him, everything associated with the functions of the chest is governed by those active elements which have their origin in sulfur, or in that which is of the nature of sulfur. And then he asks, what is at work in the rest of man's being? We would refer to this as the metabolic system. His answer is mercury. And so he has an overview of the whole of man's being. On the one hand, one sees that from the way that he formulates everything, he stands in the evening twilight of this whole way of thinking. But on the other hand, it is apparent that from his position in the fading twilight, he was still able to grasp a whole wealth of truths which were still understood at that time but are now buried, obscured from view. Truths which he is able to express by making use of the three concepts of mercury, sulfur, and salt. Thus this book, titled Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, consists of a very fine treatise, which for a modern physicist is complete nonsense, on thunderstorms, on thunder and lightning, in the course of which he shows that one can, on the one hand, use mercury, sulfur, and salt in order to explain man's bodily nature. and that, on the other hand, one can use them to explain such atmospheric phenomena. At one time, they are working together within man. At another time, they are working out in the world. In man, they give rise to the thoughts or will impulses that light up within him. Out in the world, the same elements engender phenomena such as thunder and lightning. As has been said, what St. Martin explains is something that anyone imbued with the way of thinking characteristic of the 18th century could understand perfectly well. For a modern physicist, it is total nonsense. But there is, I would say, something of a snag, quite specifically, as regards thunder and lightning in modern physics. For what it offers by way of an explanation for them is somewhat facile. It teaches that the lightning, and then the thunder in its wake, is brought about when the electric charges between two clouds, one of which is positively and the other negatively charged, are balanced out. A schoolboy who has his wits about him, and has previously noticed that when the teacher carries out electrical experiments, he carefully wipes away any dampness so that the instruments are dry, because nothing works with electricity whenever there is any dampness, may say, quote, "Yes, but surely the clouds are so damp that the electricity cannot function in them as you say it does," close quote. The teacher would then say, quote, "You're a silly boy. You don't understand," close quote. It would be difficult for him to answer in any other way today. St. Martin tries to explain how mercury and sulfur are connected in a particular way, through the salt in the air. And then he goes on to show how, in a similar way, saltpeter and sulfur are united through charcoal in gunpowder, and, therefore, how explosions can arise through a particular transmutation of the elements of mercury and sulfur by means of the presence of salt. This explanation, arising out of the way that the concepts of mercury, sulfur, and salt were understood at that time, is remarkably ingenious. I cannot enter into it more deeply now, but we shall consider the whole subject more from an historical point of view. St. Martin shows particularly well how the distinctive relationship of lightning to salt, or what he calls salt, is proved through certain properties of air after thunderstorms. In short, St. Martin battled in his own way against the materialism that was already looming through, having behind him the foundations of a traditional wisdom, which found in him a highly significant expositor. By this means he aspired toward an explanation of the world as a whole, and after having given the interpretations that make use of the elements of which we have been speaking, he proceeded to an explanation of earthly evolution. In this respect, he is not so foolish as those born after him, who believe in a primordial mist in their belief that one can arrive at the beginning of the world with physical concepts. Rather, does he have recourse to imaginations in his wish to explain the origin of the earth? In the book we find a wonderful richness of imaginative ideas when he addresses this theme. Ideas which, like his physical concepts, can only be understood out of the age in which he lived. We would not be able to make use of such ideas any longer, but they indicate that from a certain point onward he endeavored to grasp things with an imaginative perception. Then, having explored this area, he moves on to developing an understanding of the historical life of man. He tries to establish that historical life can only be understood if one sees that, from time to time, spiritual impulses have been entering into the physical world from the spiritual world. He then tries to apply this general idea to man's deeper nature, by showing that what is described in the biblical legend of the fall from paradise derives, according to his imaginative perception, from definite facts, and that man has arrived at his present condition from one in the primordial past. He endeavors to understand the historical phenomena of his time, and of historical time in general, from the fall of spiritual life into matter. I am not necessarily defending this, but am merely describing it. Of course, I am not wanting to replace spiritual science or anthroposophy with St. Martin's teachings. I merely wish to relate this in order to show how far advanced St. Martin was at that time. As we read Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, chapter by chapter, we keep coming across something quite remarkable. We find that St. Martin speaks out of a rich abundance of knowledge, and that what he actually communicates represents, I would say, only the outermost layers of the knowledge that lives in his soul. He indicates this in several passages of his book. This is the gist of what he says. Quote, "If I were to explore this issue at a deeper level, I would have to divulge truths that I may not pronounce." Close quote. At one point he even says, quote, "If I were to say all that needs to be said on this subject, I would have to unveil certain truths that for most people are better left enshrouded in the deepest darkness of night." Close quote. A true spiritual scientist can discern a great deal from these remarks, and he also knows why these observations appear at particular points of certain chapters. One cannot speak unconditionally about certain things. It will only be possible to speak about certain things when the impulses that have been given through spiritual science have become moral impulses, when human beings have attained a certain high-mindedness through spiritual science, so that one is able to speak about certain questions in a different way than is possible when remarkable scientific figures such as Freud and his syndicate are at work. In the last third of his book, St. Martin moves on to discussing certain political topics. It is scarcely possible in our present time to do more than merely indicate how to relate the way that St. Martin thought at that time to the way that humanity, as it were, in quotes, thinks now, for that is a forbidden subject. I can merely say that the whole attitude that St. Martin adopts in this last third of his book is really quite remarkable. If we read this chapter, we must do so today in such a way that we are clearly aware that it appeared, together with the rest of the book, in 1775, and that the French Revolution followed only after this chapter had been written. This chapter must be thought of in connection with the French Revolution, and a great deal needs to be read between the lines. But St. Martin proceeds as an occultist, someone who lacks the organs of perception to recognize the profound impulses living in this chapter of the book will probably be very appreciative of the introduction that St. Martin supplies for this chapter. For what he says is this, quote, "No one should think that I am trying to inveigle myself into anyone's presence. Anyone who has anything to do with the ruling powers of the earth or is connected in some way with the government should be very far from thinking that I am trying to approach them. I am a friend of all and everyone." Close quote. But after excusing himself in this way, he says certain things that make Rousseau's statements seem like child's play. However, I cannot say more about this. In short, we are dealing here with a person of great significance, who was the leader of a school, and without whom Herder, Goethe, Schiller, and German Romanticism in general can hardly be imagined, just as he is barely conceivable without Jakob Boehme. Nevertheless, if one reads him today and allows oneself to be influenced by what he says, the fact is that, as I have just said, there would not be the slightest point in speaking to some sort of public audience in the way that St. Martin wrote, as I did last Thursday and Saturday, and will do so again next Thursday, when I was trying to delineate a picture of the world, which, on the one hand, is absolutely correct from a spiritual, scientific point of view, and on the other is equally correct from the standpoint of the most meticulous scientific discoveries of the present. The way that St. Martin formulated his ideas is no longer suited to the way that people need to think today and apply their thoughts. Just as someone traveling from one linguistic region to another needs to use not the language of the first region, but that of the second, it would be absurd today to try to explain everything in the way that St. Martin did. And it would be particularly absurd because there is between us and them that mighty dividing wall in spiritual evolution, which dates from 1842, thus at the end of the first third of the 19th century. From this you can see that it is possible for a certain way of thinking to fade into oblivion in the spiritual evolution of mankind. But if one studies St. Martin, one does not really have the feeling that his thoughts have lost their relevance. This is certainly not the case, and one has, on the contrary, the feeling that there is such an enormous amount of undiscovered treasures of wisdom in his work that a great deal could still be extracted from it. Nevertheless, there is, on the other hand, a need in the spiritual evolution of mankind for this way of thinking to come to an end and another to begin. This is indeed a reality. For in the former period, the outer world was still in a rudimentary stage of its present development, and its more extreme materialistic phase was only just beginning. We can, therefore, only really understand what actually happened then if we survey longer periods of time, when what spiritual science seeks to arouse within us today can be discerned over a wider span of time. For, of course, what St. Martin expressed at the end of the 18th century, when present developments were still in an incipient form, looked quite different from the way that it does today. At that time, in general, something was coming to an end. Not only was this the case in the sense that the ideas still inspiring Jacob Boehme, Paracelsus, St. Martin, and others in the later phase of the evening twilight of this whole way of thinking could no longer be implemented, but something highly significant was also taking place in the way people felt. Whereas in St. Martin we see, in the context of this phenomenon of the evening twilight, a human mind focused more upon nature, the same phenomenon manifests itself in a somewhat different way if we cast our eye on the almost parallel decline of theosophy, on the fading glow of the theosophical view of the world. It is true that St. Martin is also generally referred to as a theosophist, but I have in mind, when I characterize St. Martin, a theosophy that is focused more upon natural science, and a theosophy that was more widely prevalent as one of a more religious nature. In this very particular form, it reached a culmination in Swabia, one cannot really refer to South Germany, where at the time of this period of general decline, when it also reached a quite particular maturity, two individuals in particular stood out among the various other figures, namely Bengel and Ettinger. They were surrounded by a large number of others. I shall mention only those with whom I am more familiar: Friedrich Daniel Schubart, the mathematician Hahn, then Steinhofer, the schoolmaster Hartmann, who had great influence on Jung Stilling, and was also personally acquainted with Goethe, then Johann Jakob Moser, a large number of remarkable individuals, in relatively modest positions, who did not form a coherent group, but who all lived at the time when Ettinger's star also shone. Ettinger's life almost spanned the entire 18th century. He was born in 1702 and died as a prelate in Murrhardt, a highly remarkable personality in whom was concentrated, in a certain sense, the essence of what lived in this whole circle. This theosophy of the 18th century found an echo in Richard Walter, who, in addition to teaching at other universities, taught mainly in Heidelberg, and wrote a very fine preface to a book which Karl August Auberlin published on, titled The Theosophy of Friedrich Christoph Ettinger. In this preface, Richard Rothe, who represents an echo of all the traditions of this circle, on the one hand, out of his theosophical convictions, recalls the theosophy of those great theosophists whose names I have listed, and on the other hand, speaks in such a way that one can clearly see how he feels in looking back at the twilight period, with regard to those mysteries of life with which he was concerned as a theosophist. Thus, in this preface, which was written in 1847, Richard Rothe writes about Ettinger. I should like to quote some of it here, and I want to do so in order that you can see that Richard Rothe, who was then in Heidelberg, was someone who, in his review of Ettinger's work, saw him as a person who, in his own way, endeavored above all to study the scriptures, both the Old and the New Testaments, out of a theosophical understanding of the world. Richard Rothe looked back at this particular way of reading the scriptures and compared it with the way that he died only in the 1860s and was therefore very much of a latecomer, had learned them, which was how it generally happened at the time. He compared this latter way of reading the scriptures with the methods of Bengel, Ettinger, Steinhofer, the mathematician and astronomer Hahn, and others. In this regard, Richard Rothe says something quite remarkable, quote, "Among the men belonging to this group, which included Bengel and his Apocalyptica, Ettinger occupied a foremost position. Dissatisfied with the academic theology of his time, he thirsted for a richer and fuller, but at the same time also a purer, understanding of Christian truth. Orthodox theology did not satisfy him. He thought it shallow. He wanted more than this, not because it asked too much of his faith, but because his profound mind needed more than it had to give. He did not have a problem with its supernatural aspect, the supernatural quality of the theology of his time, but with the fact that it did not take this aspect seriously enough. He inwardly rebelled very strongly against the spiritualism current at the time, which reduced the realities of the world of Christian belief to pale abstractions, to mere intellectual images. Hence his fiery zeal against all idealism." Close quote. Such a sentence might seem strange, but one needs to understand what it means. By idealism, a German understands a system that lives purely in ideas, whereas Ettinger, and with him also Rothe, had a truly spiritual aspiration. They were people who really wanted to move history forward, unlike what Ranke and people like him and all the others with their colorless ideas referred to as so-called historical ideas. Parenthesis, as if it were possible for ideas, and indeed no mere word is adequate if one is wanting to speak in a real way, to wander through history and carry human affairs forward, close parenthesis. These people wanted to replace dead abstractions with a more vibrant quality. Quote, "This is the reason for Ettinger's fiery zeal against all idealism, his realism, which did, as a matter of fact, contrary to his intentions, tend toward materialism, his energetic urge toward massive concepts." Close quote. These are ideas which really take hold of spiritual realities, ideas which do not refer to an ideal archetype underlying everything, but are really, in quotes, massive or substantial thoughts and ideas that reach out toward spiritual beings themselves. Rothe continues, quote, "Moreover, his way of relating to nature and to the natural sciences was closely connected with this fundamental scientific attitude. The contemptuous disdain with which the idealist treats the natural world was foreign to him. He sensed a very real existence behind its coarse material veneer, and was deeply convinced that without nature there could be no true, because no real, existence, whether of a divine or created origin." Close quote. There was something surprising about this, as it gave a new strength to the historical verification of the view of which we have been speaking, that in this thirst for a real understanding of nature, not only in Ettinger but also in the earlier and the contemporary Protestant theosophists, and especially in Jakob Boehme, the original scientific tendency of the age of the Reformation was bursting through once more. Quote, "The kind of realism for which Ettinger yearned came to birth in its innermost essence in Christianity," close quote, says Richard Walter. Continue quote, "If transplanted into a different spiritual stream, it will inevitably develop weaknesses, especially as regards certain aspects of its very specific doctrine. It is also capable of sustaining a Christian world of miracles, which has a completely different kind of richness from the idealism in which we have been educated from a young age, which is always governed by the fear of thinking in too real a way about divine things, and of taking the word of God too literally. Indeed, this Christian realism demands such a world of miracles as is manifested in the teaching about the last things. It will not be confounded in its eschatological hopes by a sympathetic shaking of the heads of those who deem themselves to be alone capable of understanding. For it has no conception of how a thoughtful understanding of created things and their history is possible without a clear idea about the ultimate result of world evolution, which, as the goal and purpose of creation, can alone shed light on its true significance. Finally, it does not shrink from the thought of a real, immediate, and therefore truly living spirit world, and an equally real contact with that world on the part of man, even in his present state. The reader will confirm how precisely all this accords with what Ettinger says." Close quote. Here you have a reference to a time when there was a quest not for ideas of nature, but for a living spiritual world. And indeed, Ettinger tried to bring together in his life all the treasures of human knowledge that were accessible to him in order to attain a living relationship with the spiritual world. What stood behind this man? He was not like a person of the present day. People in the present day have, above all, the task of showing how modern natural science must allow itself to be corrected by spiritual science, in order that a true knowledge might come into being. Ettinger strove for something different. He aimed to demonstrate the necessity of finding a relationship with the living world of the Spirit if one is to arrive at an understanding of the Bible, the Scriptures, and especially the New Testament. Richard Walter speaks about this in a very beautiful way. Quote, "In order to understand this, one needs to take into account his," close quote, that is, Ettinger's, continue quote, "position, or rather his inner inclination toward the Holy Scriptures, his living awareness that a right, that is, a complete and therefore also utterly accurate understanding of the Bible is still lacking, that the interpretations of the Bible given by the churches do not do this justice. I can make what I want to say about Ettinger," or close quote, Steiner again. Oh, no. This is a continued quote. "I can make what I want to say about Ettinger as clear as possible if I relate my own experience of working with the Holy Scriptures for over 30 years," close quote, writes Richard Walter, continue quote, "especially with the New Testament, and above all with the words of the Redeemer and the epistles of Paul. The impression that I receive from the Scriptures, the more I study them, if I approach them with the help of our commentaries, is that I have an ever more lively sense of their exuberant fecundity, not merely as regards the inexhaustible ocean of feeling that surges through them, the pathe sacrae scriptura, as Bengel calls it, but no less in view of the thoughts expressed through their words. I stand before them with a key which the Church has placed in my hand as the fruit of the trials of many centuries. I cannot exactly say that it does not fit, but still less can I say that it is the right one. It just about opens the door, but only if I use force to release the lock. Our traditional exegesis, I am not referring to modern interpretations, enables me to understand the scriptures. But it is not enough to enable me to arrive at a complete and accurate understanding of them. It is certainly able to evoke the general content of the thoughts, but it fails to imbue the distinctive form in which these thoughts appear with life. After a traditional interpretation has been made, it always seems to me that a blossom is left hovering above the text. This is left behind as an unexplained residue from the words of the text, which, however conscientiously they may have carried out their task, presents the Bible commentators and those who refer to them and what they say in a very unfavorable light. Indeed, it is made to appear as if our Lord and the apostles wished to say only this and precisely that, in accordance with what the commentators allowed them to say, and it was made unnecessarily difficult for those who heard and read what they said to understand them, because they expressed themselves so clumsily and awkwardly, or, to be perfectly honest, in such a curious way. Our exegetic literature, in its vast, unfathomable compass, represents in this respect a serious complaint about them, in that they spoke with so little clarity and objectivity, and yet with ornate language about such incomparably important things and to such an incomparably important end. But who does not feel that this complaint is unwarranted? A careful reader of the Bible receives the totally unambiguous impression that the way it is worded is absolutely right, that there are no meaningless flourishes which our exegesis has to cut away like wild vines from the composition of the Scriptures before it is able to enter into their actual content, and that the long-established custom of these scholars of removing the dust from the words of Scripture, on the grounds that they are so old and inadequate, before interpreting them, leads to the incomparable luster through which they have shone forth for centuries in the imperishable, spring-like radiance of eternal youth being wiped away from them. The masters of biblical interpretation can smile as much as they want, but the fact remains that between the lines of the Bible text something is written which, despite all their skill, they are unable to read. And yet it is above all this that people need to be able to read in order to understand the thoroughly distinctive form in which the, among us, generally acknowledged thoughts of divinely revealed truth come before us only in the Holy Scriptures, in characteristic contrast to all of the descriptions of such truths. Our interpreters merely point out the figures standing in the foreground of the panorama of the Scriptures, but they ignore the background, with its beautifully formed mountain ranges in the far distance, and its radiant dark blue sky with wisps of clouds. And yet from it there falls on these scholars that unique magical light, in which they receive an illumination, which is for us the most enigmatic part about them. The distinctive fundamental thoughts and perceptions that lie as the unspoken premise of the way in which the Scriptures express what they have to say are lacking. And no less of an absence is the real soul of the Scriptures, the inner connection of the individual elements of the thoughts expressed in the Bible, which is the bond organically linking all the separate thoughts of the Scriptures together. No wonder, then, that there are hundreds of passages in our Bibles which therefore continually elude interpretation and cannot be properly understood, in such a way that the details of the text are fully recognized as making sense in all their minute features. No wonder that, in so many instances, we have a whole wealth of different interpretations, which have since time immemorial been in dispute with one another, without there being any outcome to the battle. No wonder, for they will probably all be wrong, because all of them are imprecise or approximate, and only reflect the meaning in general terms. We approach the texts of the Bible with the alphabet of our basic concepts of God and the world, taking it for granted, and in all good faith, that the alphabet of the biblical commentators which stands as a silent premise at the background of everything that they think and write as individuals, and shines through everything, will be the same as ours. But that is unfortunately an illusion, from which experience should have cured us a long time ago. Our key doesn't work. The right key has been lost. And until we find it again, our Bible studies will not bear fruit. The framework of basic biblical concepts, which is not outwardly expressed in the Scriptures, but is merely present as an underlying premise, is lacking. It is not present among our scholars. And for as long as we undertake our research without it, the Bible must remain a half-closed book. We must approach it with different basic concepts from the familiar ones that we are used to regarding as the only possible options. And whatever these may be and wherever they may be sought, one thing at any rate is absolutely clear from the whole sound of the melody of the Scriptures in its natural fullness, that they must be more realistic and more, in quotes, massive or substantial. I have here merely reported my own experience. I am far from wanting to force it on anyone for whom it is alien, but believe with full confidence that Ettinger would understand me and would assure me that it was also the same in his case. But there are also some of our contemporaries who, in this respect, despite the objections that are raised against me, will stand alongside me. Among many I could name, I refer to one in particular, the celebrated Dr. Beck in Tübingen. Close quote. Steiner again. Ettinger tried to arrive at an understanding of the Bible by endeavoring to find inner inspiration in the ideas that still retained some vitality in the evening twilight in which both he and St. Martin lived, and to enter into a living connection with the spiritual world, for only then did he hope that the true language of the Bible might be revealed to him. His premise was firmly of this nature, that with purely abstract intellectual ideas, one will fail to understand the most important things in the Bible, especially the New Testament, and that one will only come near to the true meaning of the New Testament if one is able to understand that this New Testament has come out of a direct perception of the spiritual world itself, that no commentaries or exegeses are necessary, but that above all one needs to be able to read the New Testament. To this end he sought a philosophia sacra. This was not to be a philosophy according to the model of what came after, but one in which was inscribed what a person may really experience if he lives in communion with the spiritual world. Just as we, who want to shed a scientific light on spiritual scientific research, are not able to speak in the way that St. Martin did, so are we equally unable to speak like Ettinger, or still less like Bengel, if we speak today about the Gospels. Nevertheless, the addition of the New Testament brought out by Bengel will continue to be of use, but his Apocalyptica, of which he thought so much, is not of the slightest interest to anyone now. For Ettinger himself, the Apocalypse was fairly remote. For Bengel, who was the older man, it was very immediate. In his studies on this theme, he attached a particular importance to calculations. He regarded one number as being of particular importance. And the mere fact that he considered this number to be particularly important is enough in itself for a modern thinking person, and of course I say modern thinking person in inverted commas, to regard Bengel as a muddlehead, a fanciful visionary, and a fool. For according to his calculations, the year 1836 was to be especially important in the evolution of humanity. He made very extensive calculations. Of course, he lived in the first part of the 18th century, so he was separated from this year by a century. He worked this out by considering the historical phenomena in his own way. But if one looks deeper at the relevant phenomena, without the, in quotes, cleverness of the modern mind, one realizes that the good Bengel erred in his calculations by only 6 years. This error arose from an incorrect estimate of the founding of Rome, and this can easily be verified. He had meant to arrive with his calculations at the year 1842, the year that I have given for the materialistic crisis. Bengel, the teacher of Ettinger, was referring to that deep rift. But because he went too far in his search for really massive or substantial concepts, he thought on too large a scale, and imagined the outward course of history in such a way that something special was going to take place, which would be like a doomsday, an end of everything. But it was only a day of doom for the ancient wisdom. Thus we see the decline of a theosophical age at a not so very distant date from our own time. And yet if someone is writing an account of history or philosophy, he will, if he mentions these people at all, at most devote a few lines to them, which will, as a rule, say very little at all. Nevertheless, these people wielded a very considerable influence. And if someone today asks, what is the meaning of the second part of Goethe's Faust, and answers in the way that many commentators have done, we cannot but be surprised that, quote, he who cleaves to shallow things can keep his hopes alive on empty terms, and dig with greed for precious plunderings, and find his happiness unearthing worms, close quote. In this second part of Faust, there is an enormous amount of occult wisdom and a reflection of occult facts, expressed in a truly poetic form. All this would be inconceivable if it had not been preceded by that world that I have been trying to characterize to you by means of two main examples. People today really have no idea of how much was still known about the spiritual world a relatively short time ago, and how much has become obscured in recent decades. In any event, it is very important that we are aware that we are only just beginning to read the Gospels again, because we are only just learning how to do so through what spiritual science is able to impart to us today. There is something very remarkable about Ettinger. There is in his writings a sentence which is quoted again and again, but is never understood. A sentence which would alone enable anyone with the requisite insight to say that he is one of the greatest figures in cultural history. This is the sentence in German, Die Materie ist das Ende der Wege Gottes. Parenthesis, a literal rendering of which would be, matter is the end of the ways of God. Close parenthesis. Such a definition of matter, which so closely corresponds with what the spiritual scientist is able to know, could only be given by a very highly developed soul, who is able to understand how the divinely spiritual creative powers work and concentrate their energies in order to bring a material structure into being, such as man, for example, which in its form expresses the ultimate manifestation of an enormous concentration of forces. If you read what is said in the conversation between Capasius and Benedictus at the beginning of the second mystery play, about the relationship of the macrocosm to man, which causes Capasius to fall ill, you will be able to form an idea of how, through modern spiritual science, one can express, in our words, those things that Ettinger was able to characterize by means of this phrase, which we can only understand once we have rediscovered its meaning. Matter is the end of the ways of God. But it is also the same in his case. We are unable to speak in his words, no more than in those of St. Martin. Anyone who utters them must have a special fondness for preserving what can no longer be understood. However, not only have ideas undergone a considerable transformation, the same can also be said of feelings. Just think of a typical person who exemplifies our modern age, someone who embodies its essential features and attitudes. And imagine what he would make of St. Martin's book, Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, if he were to open it and chance upon the sentence, quote, man is protected from knowing the principle of his outward physical bodily nature. For if he were to know the principle of his physical bodily nature, he would be too ashamed to be able to look at a naked human being. Close quote. in an age when people long for nudity on the stage, as the typical examples of modern humanity are the first to do, it is not possible to make anything of such a sentence. Just think, along comes a great philosopher called St. Martin who understands the world, and he explains that a higher sense of shame makes us blush when we see a human form. And yet for St. Martin, this is totally understandable. You see, I initially wanted to indicate today that something has become obscured which has immense significance. But my particular wish was to draw attention to the fact that people used to speak in a language that we are no longer able to speak. We have to speak differently now. Thinking capacities that formerly existed have been lost in order that we may speak in this language today. But we find both in Ettinger and in St. Martin that things have not been thought through to the end, and they can be taken further. One can continue to discuss them, but not with a modern human being. I should like to go further and say, one does not need to speak about them further if one raises questions today about the riddles of the world, because we need to develop our understanding, not with ideas from the past, but with ideas belonging to the present. This is why so much emphasis is placed here on linking everything arrived at through spiritual scientific research with the concepts of the present. It is a remarkable phenomenon that, however much importance one attaches to not returning to these ideas, their potential has not yet been fulfilled. It is apparent from the ideas themselves that there is much more to be thought about along these lines. People have no conception of how these ideas actually form part of a wider consciousness, because they are governed by the strange notion that the way of thinking that prevails today has always been as it is now. The typical person of whom I spoke earlier thinks as follows: I call these little white particles, this white powder in the salt cellar, salt. Now this typical person knows that salt has different names in different languages, but that people have always understood them as referring to what he sees today. This is simply assumed, but it is not true. Even the most uneducated peasant in the 17th or 18th centuries, and for quite some while afterward, had a far broader conception of what he meant when he said the word salt. His picture was one of which that of St. Martin was a more concentrated version. Instead of the present materialistic conception, he was aware of something connected with spiritual life when he spoke of salt. Words were not as materialized as they are today. They were not merely concerned with a separate material essence. We read in the Gospels that Christ says to the disciples, quote, "You are the salt of the earth," close quote. Yes, when this is expressed in the modern words, "you are the salt of the earth," it does not have the same meaning as it did when Christ spoke these words. Because one inevitably experiences the word salt through the whole inner relationship that a person has today with respect to the word salt. And however broad his conception may be, this will not be of any help. If a person today is to have the same experience that would have arisen at that time from the value attached to the word salt, it would be necessary to shift one's understanding of the meaning in such a way that what is there is not salt, but something else. One has to do something similar with respect to a great many old documents, particularly with the Holy Scriptures. And many errors have been committed in this regard, especially in connection with them. It is therefore not difficult to understand why Ettinger tried to make a large number of historical studies in order to arrive at the true value of the words and to gain an appropriate feeling for them. Of course, anyone with a mind like Ettinger's would be considered mad carrying out alchemical experiments and studying Kabbalistic books simply in order to find out how the words of a sentence were really to be understood. For all his efforts were devoted to the words of the sentences of the Holy Scriptures. I have spoken of these things today, on the one hand, in order to show that now at the dawn of a new age, it is necessary to speak in a different way about them from how this was done in the twilight of a former age. But I should like, on the other hand, to return to the strange fact that according to the prevailing view of our time, out of which spiritual science also has to develop, it would appear to be a matter of indifference whether one studies the manner of thought of the time of Bengel, Ettinger, St. Martin, and others. For if one is speaking to educated people today, one has to speak about the digestive system, the respiratory system, and the nervous system. One cannot speak about mercury, sulfur, and salt in connection with the body. These concepts, which were still understood by those who worked with them in the time of Paracelsus, Jakob Boehme, St. Martin, and Ettinger, are no longer understood today. Nevertheless, it is by no means without value to concern oneself with these matters. And there would still be some point in doing so, even if one does not have the opportunity to speak to cultured people out of a background of these ideas. I am willing to admit that it would not be very clever to introduce notions such as mercury, sulfur, and salt into modern thinking. Not only would I regard this as unintelligent, it would also not be right. Anyone who feels the pulse of his time will not make the mistake of wishing to restore these old ideas in the way that certain so-called occult societies do, which attach great importance to clinging onto old vignettes. All the same, it is of the greatest significance to acquire a faculty in this language which is no longer spoken today, and whose last word has by no means been uttered in the works of St. Martin and Ettinger, or in earlier times those of Paracelsus and Jakob Boehme. Why is this? Yes, why? People of the present day do not speak in this way. They might abandon this language. And at the most, one might focus one's mind on the historical phenomenon of how such an historical epoch was unable to find fulfillment. How it came about that there was something that could have been carried further, but which came to a standstill despite its having this potential for further development. How can this be? What is at the bottom of this? It could well be that people will be completely unable to understand one another if, despite learning everything that has to be learned, they have not taken these ideas into account. There is something here of immense significance. The living no longer speak about these ideas. They neither have to speak about them nor need to do so. And yet the language of these ideas is all the more important for the dead, for those who have passed through the portal of death. If the need arises to make oneself understood by the dead or by other particular spirits of the spiritual world, one learns to recognize that in a certain respect it is necessary to become familiar with that unfulfilled language which at that former time died out as regards the physical earthly life of the physical plane. And it is precisely among those who have passed through the portal of death that what lives in these ideas will gradually become a vibrant force, for it will be for them the familiar language that they are seeking. And the more efforts are made to live into these ideas as they were thought, felt, and imagined at that time, the more will one succeed in making oneself understood by the spirits who have passed through the portal of death. A process of mutual understanding is then able to develop. And then the extraordinary and remarkable mystery is disclosed that thought forms of a certain kind have been living on the earth but have been developed only to a certain point and are no longer being developed further on the earth. But they are being taken further among those who enter into the life between death and a new birth. No one should think that anything can be done solely with what one can learn today about the formation of sulfur, quicksilver, mercury is not quicksilver, of sulfur, quicksilver, and salt. If one only has these concepts, one finds that they are useless for acquiring a relationship with the dead through their language. But if one relates to these ideas in the way that Paracelsus and Jacob Boehme did, and also as St. Martin, Bengel, and Ettinger were able to do, in what I might describe as their tendency towards superabundance, one notices that by this means a bridge is built between this world and the other world. Of course, people may laugh about Bengel's calculations. After all, they have no conceivable value for outward physical life. But for those who are between death and a new birth, these calculations make a great deal of sense. For rifts in development such as Bengel tried to calculate, and he was only 6 years out, are of far-reaching significance. You see, therefore, that the world here on the physical plane and the world of the spirit are not connected in such a way that the link between them can be forged through abstract formulas, but they are connected in an utterly concrete way. The meaning that is becoming lost here in the physical world rises up into the spiritual world and lives on with those who have died, provided that on the part of the living it is succeeded by a new phase. We shall continue with this next time. That is the end of Lecture 7 and the end of the first part of the book, which is essentially called Human Life in a Cosmic Context, which is part of this collected work. The remaining lectures are, in fact, the main 10 lectures of Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. End of Lecture 7.